Good morning, Dr. McLaughlin. How is the machine working today? All right, shall we see how in what voice you are this morning?
How am I talking this morning?
Well, we'll find out. Well, you were just saying that you had been in the in Peru, in the area where the major earthquake was.
Yes. I was up there, I think, in the early 20s. It must have been about 1920. I could look it up. 1920 or 21, I went up to see a mine in the named Magistral, which was to the north of the Callejón de Huayles.
Now I'm going to have to get the names a little more.
Yes,
my Spanish isn't the equal to
that. That name, Magistral, was the name of the mine I went. Magistral.
Magistral.
And that was to the north of the Callejón, Callejón de Huayles.
Huayles.
Or just one L, I think. Huayles, Huayles. And this was a copper mine that was rather intriguing, but just wasn't big enough to be worth spending much money on, but it took me in there twice to see it. And on the second trip, I rode back all the way from that place in northern Peru to Cerro de Pasco, that's C-E-R-R-O.
Yes, that one I do recall.
Overland and down through the Callejón de Huayles, and then across the range in that famous gorge called the Llanganuco, L-L-A-N-Q-E-N-O, Llanganuco, G-E, I'll have to correct the spelling on that.
Right, we'll query that one. That's
Llanganuco. And that's an extraordinary region in Peru. The Santa River runs from south to north for a long distance between two ranges of the Andes, one on the right, one on the east, called the Cordillera Blanca, the White Cordillera, the one on the west, which also goes up to 15 or 16,000 feet, called the Cordillera Negra, because it has no ice or glaciers on it.
Oh, I see.
And then the river makes a turn and goes through the Cordillera Negra in a perfectly enormous canyon out to the coast at Chimbote.
Oh, yes.
And that canyon cuts down from ranges that are up around 15, 16,000 feet down to about 2,000 feet. So it's a perfectly enormous gorge. And there was a railroad started up that canyon back in the early days and then back in the 20s, a meter gauge railroad, which was just a series of tunnels and bridges and so on. And when I went in that first time, the grades had been finished some years before that, with many tunnels, and they were then putting in bridges, going to put in the rails. We went to the railhead and then rode horseback up through the tunnels, and it was quite a job getting mules across some of these railroad bridges with just some planks on them. And when we left, the railroad went part way up this gorge. Then we left the railroad then and crossed the Big Santa River on a swinging rope bridge and then started north to this mine. But on the way back I went right on up the Callejón de Huayles itself and stopped at some, spent nights in some of those little towns like Huayles and Yungay, Y-U-N-G-A-Y, is one of the towns that was completely wiped out in this earthquake.
Oh,
and this gorge of the Llanganuco that I mentioned is, I should think it's about like, it's a bigger gorge than the Yosemite, with a tremendous cliff on one side. I think it's even higher than the El Capitan. and there's a lake filling the valley, just the way there was in the Yosemite, in the glacial period. Then up on both sides of this gorge are these mountains going up to 20,000 feet or more, 21,000 Waskra, just covered with tremendous ice fields, just sort of hanging over the valley. So you might imagine the Yosemite with these tremendous mountains on both sides and ice practically hanging over it. And what I suspect happened in this earthquake is that either there were some avalanches of rock off the walls, or else the great avalanches of ice that broke loose and came down into the lake and formed a great wave in the lake that washed out the barrier.
Was that a natural barrier?
Yes,
or
it was
not a dam?
No, it was a moraine. Where the old glacier, you see, had made a natural dam. There are many, many lakes all through glaciated mountains like that. And I think I don't know, but I would guess that the great flood was due to an avalanche into the lake and the washing out of the dam, and then this just lake just emptied down into the Cajon, which is not a flat floored valley, but a long trench with a series of alluvial fans.
Yes.
And the towns are all on the alluvial fans, just the way the towns are in Southern California in so many places. And I can imagine when this flood came down, there was just no place to go. They were out in the middle of a fan, and just a flood of water, mud, rocks, and so on, came down. That would be my guess as to what happened. Well, of course, there's no report on it yet.
No. Well, these enormous variations in elevation that you speak of, under other circumstances, could this be used to generate water power?
Yes, and as a matter of fact, there's a huge hydroelectric plant has been built in this great gorge of the Santa River. I think it's called Hualanca, Hualanca. Tunnels have been put through, and in a place where there is a big drop in the rivers. The largest river, I think, on the west side of the Andes, and there's a huge hydroelectric plant there now. I've forgotten what the capacity is, but the trouble with it is they built this huge plant, and there really isn't the market for that tremendous amount of electricity up there. And there has been a lot of effort made to develop industries at the port of Chimbote, Chimbote, which has one of the best harbors on the Peruvian coast, but it's just desert country around it. And I haven't been up there for years and years. When I was there, the port was just a very insignificant little fishing village, like most of these little Peruvian towns, rather forlorn. But it was the terminal of the railroad that went to the north and then up the Santa River, eventually into the Cajon de Huales. But now the age of railroads is over. Automobile roads reach into the Cajon from the north, and I think some other ways too. Those are the roads that was the road that was destroyed in the earthquake, so people were so isolated in there. It was very hard to, apparently it's still very hard to get any help too. But there is tremendous electrical power possibilities through there, but far more than any market would take at present.
So it really awaits the development of an industry that would make use of it.
If there were any great low-grade copper or lead or zinc mines in that region, then you could have a big metallurgical works using a large amount of power down on the coast. But while there are lots of mines through that region, there's nothing up there that would, so far that would be regarded as a major mine. And I think the work being done at Chimbote, the metallurgical work, is treatment of concentrates, zinc concentrates and things of that sort that are brought in by ship and not local things.
Well, when you were prospecting, if that's the right word, in this area, was this under the auspices of the Cerro de Pasco?
Cerro de Pasco, yes. Company? Yeah. Uh-huh. And there are some there are some possibilities of some quite big mines in that general region. The home state company that I'm with, been with so long, is also doing exploration work there. We had a party up in the Cordillera Negra. We went through the earthquake. One man, I think, was hurt a little bit. We don't know how, possibly by a falling rock. But we've been doing some drilling up there with the possibility that we may be on the trail of something.
Well, the actual Cerro de Pasco mine, as I guess it's a complex of mines.
Yes.
Really. Were they specifically damaged by the earthquake?
I don't think so. The big shake didn't reach that far south. I think you... I haven't heard, but I imagine Lima felt the shake, and so did Cerro de Pasco. But it wasn't a disastrous shake. Well, last night, did you feel the earthquake, 8:30?
No, I didn't. I missed them all.
There was quite a sharp earthquake in Danville, the paper said this morning. And here it was a bump, and this lamp went back and forth like that.
Right.
Just a bump.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, of course, as a geologist, you must find all of this earth movement very interesting.
Yes, here we are sitting right on the Hayward Rift.
Exactly so.
But it didn't. This apparently was a shake on the Calaveras fault last night that shook up Danville. So we're getting ready for our big one here, I think.
Well, so they say, Mr. Steinbrugge thinks so.
Yes.
Perhaps you've seen his little book about the earthquake problem.
I really think we've built up a disaster potential here that is just appalling. If we had an earthquake like 1906, what it could do, it's just appalling.
How could one have avoided this?
By not having so many people, not having such big cities.
Yes.
And then here we are with practically no transportation except automobiles. And think of what would happen if we had a big fire, a big disaster and a big fire, and these millions of people trying to get out of the city. It has been so stupid of San Francisco ever to put up these tall buildings. I don't think the tall buildings are going to collapse. I think the engineering is good enough for that, but it could be a terrifying experience to be in them. And they also could shed a lot of the granite veneer and things of that sort they put on them, and glass, which would make it very unpleasant to be out on the street.
Yes, and of course one wouldn't want to be on the 30th floor with the elevator a little askew.
No. I haven't been in one of these buildings in an earthquake. I missed the one. When was it? March, back in the 50s, which was quite a shake. And we had the 26th floor of the Shell building then. And I happened to be driving to the airport, didn't feel the earthquake at all. But they told me the building just had a great sway to it, and it was so terrifying that we had to let most of the staff go home.
They were just literally shaken up.
Well, they were just girls for hysterical. But one of my friends said it felt very good when it started to sway back.
Yes, I sure did. Well, you were saying that automobile transport is not the best in case of this kind of disaster. Would you think rail transport would be more reliable?
Well, it would certainly help. And but you could just imagine the way these roads would be clogged by if people had to get out.
Yes.
Even the commuters are clogging the bridge now with the strike, mm-hmm. and the buses. And then there are no ferries.
Yes.
Down in San Francisco and the big fire, the many people, of course, used the ferries to get out of San Francisco.
Yes, that's right.
Now everybody would try to get out on two bridges.
Oh, that would
or
be
down the peninsula. depending which way was the easiest way out. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's rather an appalling setup here.
Yes, it's hard to do something retroactively, isn't it?
Well, I don't know what one could do. I think having the bark will be a big help, but I'd like to see ferries put back on the bay. You can move lots of people by ferries.
Yes.
And then it would relieve the bridges.
Mm-hmm.
I really think we're going to come to it, of having parking places and fast ferries back and forth, instead of building more bridges.
Yes, in this I think the engineers and the ecologists agree on
yes.
this one.
Mm-hmm. Something I've been saying 15 years.
Good. Well, you see?
I'm very pleased with myself.
You should be.
Yeah.
I was wondering, when we spoke about Peru a little earlier, has that area been subject to earthquakes over the years?
Oh, yes. It's part of the Pacific zone of earthquakes. There's a great series of mountain arcs and deep trenches of depressed sea level running right around the west coast of the two Americas, around Alaska, down through Japan, so on. It's a great, used to be called the Pacific Belt of Fire because there's so many volcanoes along it. And that's one of the major earthquake belts of the world. It all fits in now with these new ideas, the shifting, slow creep of continents. And we're in one of the active spots here in California.
Which direction are we creeping?
Well, here I think the continent as a whole is moving to the west with the ocean floor going in under it. But the actual faults here in California show, like the San Andreas Fault, show a horizontal shift, with the west side moving north.
Mm-hmm.
That is the 1906 earthquake, the snap on the San Andreas Rift. Definitely moved the west side of the rift to the north. And I think that's the way all these subsidiary rifts, like the Hayward Rift that we're on, the Calaveras, also show that type of movement. But the San Andreas Rift is a fracture in the earth along which the movement in geological periods is to be measured by miles. But of course that's over millions and millions of years, whereas in one little shift, a movement of a few feet would be a big earthquake.
Mm-hmm. Are you of the school that suggests that a number of minor shocks tends to relieve some of the pressures, or doesn't that work against a major earthquake?
I'm not a seismologist, and I don't know. I think you can, just as a non-expert in that field, you could look at it two ways. One would be that the minor shocks are relieving the big tension, and that's fine. And the other, the minor shocks are little cracks getting ready for the big one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that anybody can say that. There is a creep going on out here right now. There's a slow creep of the crust, with the west side going north. And there are little tiny shifts, such as the displacement in the Strawberry Creek Tunnel that goes under the stadium. That tunnel has cracked, and there is a shift, a very small one, but measurable, of the west side to the north on the Hayward Fault. And the railroad lines that go, as they turn and go into the Niles Canyon, cross that rift, and they show a slight displacement. Well, now, that one theory is there's this slow creep with little minor jiggles, and then it builds up great tension, then there's a snap. Mm-hmm. Now, if you'd relieve it in a whole series of little earthquakes, you might not have the big snap. But on the other hand, these little shakes, it really certainly don't show any big displacements, maybe just little tiny adjustments getting ready for the big ones. Mm-hmm. I don't see how anybody can tell yet. Seismologists undoubtedly could give you some elaborate reasons.
Well, there's certainly great interest in the problem of earthquakes in the area.
Oh, it certainly is. It's a critical problem.
Well, when you were a moment ago describing the Pacific Belt of Fire, it sounded in a sense as though you were also mentioning areas that had great mineral deposits. Is there a relationship between the areas in which there are mines and
Yes, I think these areas are also belts of where throughout geological history there's been a great, what we call tectonic changes, where the succession of sedimentary rocks has been intensely folded and overthrust, and then magmas or the molten material from deep in the crust has risen along those belts in much greater profusion than elsewhere where there's been no disturbance. Mm-hmm. And these molten rocks that come from deep in the crust may have started as the rocks high in iron and magnesium, so the rocks were called peridotite. But as these masses slowly rose and assimilated some of the higher rocks of the crust, and as they crystallized, they changed in composition. We get a great variety of these rocks eventually coming up into the upper crust. So we get rocks like granite and volcanic rocks like rhyolite, which are high in silica and light-colored rocks. And every now and then, in a few places, there will be cases where the very deep-seated rocks, or these deep-seated belts, actually get up close enough to the surface to be revealed eventually as the mountains wear down. Mm-hmm. Such as this rock that we have very common in California called serpentine.
Yes.
It originally was a molten mass high in iron and magnesium, probably forming a rock named peridotite, and then that became altered with water in the upper regions of the crust and converted into this peculiar greenish rock, serpentine. And those rocks, unfortunately not in California but in many other places in the world, are associated with nickel and the platinum metals. And so you might say those metals come in set zones. And the prevailing theory is that most of the metal deposits were derived as final products in the crystallization of these molten masses, that the vapors, the fluid, last fluid elements that came off and went up through cracks in the earth formed the veins, which we find silver, and spread out into broken rocks and made copper ore and so on. So there is an association of ore deposits with these belts. That is, the whole Cordillera of the Americas from the Cape Horn right through to Alaska is a belt in which you find more mineral deposits than, let's say, you do in the Mississippi. Well, I won't say the Mississippi Valley, because there's a lot of lead zinc there, too. But in general, these belts of disturbance and igneous action have been zones of metalliferous deposits.
Well, thinking just a moment then about the Homestake Mine in Lead, is
yes.
That how you pronounce it? The Lead area, is that similar to the zone that you've been describing?
That is really an uplift on the far eastern flanks of this broad belt that we could call the Cordillera of the two Americas. It's a couple of hundred miles really east of the Rocky Mountain front, if the Bighorn Mountains in that zone would be called the Rocky Mountain front. But it is still the province of this western belt, but it's way out on the eastern side of it. But the deposit, the Homestead mine, the Homestead, is in very ancient basement rocks. And it, I think it's of the same age as those very early rocks. That is, it's Precambrian is the term for the basement. That is, it's earlier than the sediments that are formed, the rocks of the Cambrian period, in which the first abundant fossils occur. So these older, very highly folded, very much altered rocks, the schists, gneisses, and things of that sort, are in a very ancient time, and the earth was very different. The continents may have been in different places. The zones of folding were totally different then. So that doesn't fit the picture. And so another great mineral belt of ore deposits in California, in North America, are in the Canadian Shield. That's the big area of Canada, which forms a great arc right around, down into Ontario and Quebec, of these older rocks that are now exposed at the surface. And there are many, many great ore deposits all through that belt. I don't want to give you the impression this belt of the rim of the Pacific is the one great mineral belt of the world, but of that period, and that's, we're still in that period of deformation. The ore deposits of that later age are certainly abundant in this belt, whereas the very, very old ones take totally different patterns. Then there's rather a disturbing theories to most American geologists that have grown up in the last 20 or 30 years that the Europeans like very much, is that many of these metalliferous deposits in sedimentary rocks were in some way or other derived from the waters that laid down the deposit. That is, that some of these deposits actually are of sedimentary origin, not of the igneous or molten origin.
And why does that disturb American geology?
Because we, in all our, from the early days in the West, we've seen these deposits that have been associated with igneous rocks until we get the idea all such deposits are that.
I see.
But now we've discovered in the Red Sea these hot brines carrying metals in certain deep basins of the Red Sea, where the metals are coming down with the sludge and the muds and the sedimentary material. And there you have a deposit being formed, which really is a sediment in seawater carrying rather interesting quantities of metals.
Now, when you say hot brine, what does
it, it's a brine would be a salt solution like seawater, and these would be warm.
Oh, not radioactive.
No. But just plain hot.
In temperature.
And strangely enough, they contain so much salt and so on that they're heavy in spite of their heat. So the hot heavy solution stays at the bottom. Well, now you can also say though that that simply postponing matters, that these metals are still derived from molten material, which I think everybody would agree.
Because the waters are picking them up somewhere.
Yes, but their distribution, their spreading out, and their deposition is really a sedimentary process. So both theories are correct.
Yes.
Those things occur on another belt of disturbance in the earth, which, like the Red Sea, Dead Sea, and the Rift Valleys of Africa, where there has been a cracking and a pulling apart of the continent with the upwelling of heat and deep molten material from the depths. though that hasn't been anything, well, that hasn't been as distinct a zone of great mineral deposits as the rim of the Pacific has been.
And I suppose the theory of how these deposits came about guides your thinking in finding what has been
deposited. Yes, in a way, it does. It all guides your thinking, though some of the theories are such broad generalities that they don't help you too much.
I see. What is the most important element in being a good geologic sleuth, let's say, in finding the metal that you're looking for? What do you need for this?
There are a great many different signs. Most of these deposits are accompanied by changes in the surrounding rock. So even if you fly over the country, the mineral districts, the places where there's likely to be mineralization are fairly conspicuous. From the rather abnormal coloration of the rocks, and in desert countries and in the high Andes, the ore deposits, the zones of mineralization are rather conspicuous that way. But set zones could be created by rather worthless mineralization. Some iron sulfides and things of that sort could also cause some of these conspicuous zones, so you could be very disappointed going after some of those and finding nothing. But it would be it's unlikely in those countries for the copper, lead and zinc to come in without enough associated things to give you rather an interesting looking region. But that's a pretty broad target too. Then you have to get down to the localities where you would find fractures and veins along the fractures and more signs of mineralization of that sort. Now all these ore deposits are greatly altered in the superficial parts, because the Earth's surface is gradually being worn down by erosion, and that means that oxidation and weathering penetrates the ground. And in most cases, many of the minerals are transformed into oxidized forms and then gradually leached out and washed out so that they disappear. Copper has a tendency to do that, so that you'll get a big zone of altered rock over a copper deposit, which there will be very little copper left. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, in certain other environments where there might be some limestone around, that copper in the oxidized zone would form minerals like malachite, which is a beautiful green, or azurite, which is a beautiful blue, and that just stares you in the face. But those deposits have been found, I think, because they're so conspicuous.
Well, these clues that you describe would be meaningful really just to someone who had had geologic training. So that, is that the basic?
Well, I think geologic training certainly helps and lets you see clues that are more subtle than the clues that a good prospector would have. But it's rather disconcerting to note how few new ore deposits one sees that somebody else had done a little digging around in the beginning, in the early days.
Really?
Most of the Peruvian deposits, like the Cerro de Pasco and Potosí in Bolivia, were old mines that were worked back in the 17th century by the Spaniards.
When you were saying that they were looking for gold and they didn't recognize...
They were looking for silver.
Oh, they were looking for silver.
There was not too much gold. There was gold. The Incas had a great deal of gold, which they probably washed from streams. But there really have been no major gold mines in that belt. Lots of small mines, but no major gold mines. And the great wealth of the Andes and Mexico was really silver. But today, you have to use much more subtle means, because the obvious things have been found. For example, in Canada, there's one of the major enterprises of Canada now is the great mines in Manitoba, at the town now called Thompson, which only 15 years ago was just empty, an empty country of, let's say, moose pasture. And there's a great nickel belt discovered there, which was very inconspicuous. You could go over and over and over, probably without spotting it. And that was discovered by recognizing this type of rock, the pyritotites, these old ultra-basic rocks, we call them, which nickel is often associated, as a zone which would attract attention. And then that was prospected by geophysical methods from the air, measuring the change in magnetism and the change in electrical conductivity, which indicated smaller targets. And then ground people went in and found some signs of nickel in the very few outcrops. Most of it is lakes, swamps, glacial sands, and so on, the few places where the rock showed. And then they put down some drill holes, got a little encouraging, put down more drill holes, and finally, after a few years, they really hit the jackpot. So now there's this quite a city up there. I don't know what it amounts to now, maybe 15,000 people. A big smelter, and mines, and railroad built in.
Is this the nickel company in which you are?
The International Nickel Company.
This is International Nickel.
Mm-hmm. And I remember the day the decision was made to go ahead with it, which was, I think, the first appropriation was $130 million. To start the railroad.
Yes.
And they had, in the first winter, they brought in great quantities of machinery and supplies in tractor trains running over the ice and the frozen country. Travel in the winter is much easier that way than in the summer. Then, of course, the railroad got in eventually.
Well, is this sort of tundra-like?
A great deal of tundra, yes, but it's still within, it's still in the forested country. It's rather scrubby, spruce forest in that far north. It's 100 miles or so south of the Barren Lands. That's where you get so far north there.
Yes.
There isn't anything except tundra, no forest.
Well, were you a prime mover?
No, I had nothing to do with it, except I was on the board, of course. Interested in it. But I've been up there many times, especially in the last few years, when they've asked me if I would serve as their chief geologist, as their consulting geologist.
Mm-hmm. And have you accepted these invitations?
Oh, yes, yes. I'm going up to some of the mines a couple of weeks now.
I see, and these are really nickel, primarily nickel.
Nickel, that deposit is nickel with there's always a little, some other metals, but nickel is dominant up there. The other great deposit of the Nickel Company, where the company started, is at Sudbury in Ontario.
Oh, yes.
And that's nickel copper, and with a very substantial amount of the platinum metals. That's a very famous geological spot. And the Nickel Company is the major company there by far. Falconbridge is the other big company there. That still is the greatest operation, the Nickel Company. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's a fascinating geological place. It's interesting to see how theories have grown up over the years about it, starting with certain rather simple theories of the nickel and the copper separating out from a great molten sheet in the bottom, and then how that theory has had to be modified. There's still some truth in it, but present theories are going a long way beyond that. One of the most entertaining theories now is that great oval area known as the Sudbury Basin was formed in Precambrian time, early in Precambrian time, by the impact of a huge meteor, an asteroid. And strangely enough, the theory has a great deal to commend it.
Outer space isn't so far away.
No.
And Now, this impact of the asteroid would be an entirely different theory from the magma theory or the water deposit theory?
No, the impact was so great that it caused a great rupture in the Earth's surface and a welling up of deep material.
Oh, so that brought
I don't think up. So far anybody is urged, says that the nickel and the iron and the copper came in with the asteroid. Though that is a possibility because the little meteors that come through the Earth are iron nickel.
There are some legends, aren't there, Latin American legends, that these things came from the sky, the metals came from the sky?
Well, the meteors, you've seen these meteors that come through. There are two sorts, and one is a sort of a rocky material, and the other is really an iron-nickel alloy. Most of them are the iron-nickel alloys. Mm-hmm. So it's not entirely unreasonable that a chunk of that stuff could have come in and could have been a source of the iron-nickel, but nobody really, I don't think any of the people who studied it in great depth believe that. They believe that the theory is that the impact created structural weaknesses and a long sequence of events where the deep material welled up from the depths of the earth and took advantage of this peculiar broken region to make this very unusual ring, almost oval cup-shaped mass of rock. It's called the Sudbury intrusive. You even call it the nickel intrusive. The old theory was that all the nickel really came out of that intrusive.
It just suggests that almost any force that alters the balance or makes a shift causes some reaction.
Some tremendous thing.
That brings.
Can do, yes. Mm-hmm. That the Earth really is a very mobile thing if you give it enough time. And these zones and places where something drastic has occurred are places where you can get these unusual events and unusual concentrations of the metals. Mm-hmm. This extraordinary theory of shifting continents came out back in my days in college. There was a book by an Austrian, I think he was an Austrian or a German, named Wegener, Wegener, called about the continental shifts, and he made sort of an interesting, plausible story about it, but it seemed so wild that it was almost discredited. Nobody took it seriously, that North and South America pulled away from Europe and Africa over a certain hundreds of millions of years, relatively late geological time, and he matched different rocks on each side, and of course the shapes look like it. And now this mid-Atlantic ridge has been carefully worked out by soundings with indicating a distribution of sediments that get progressively older as you go out from this ridge. And with a peculiar trench at the top of it. Of course, that is a ridge for the number of volcanic islands, starting with Iceland and running down to St. Helena. Mm-hmm. And the theory is now an accepted theory. There's this slow creep in the earth, and the continents have drifted apart. And that ties up with the Pacific zone. They're pulling apart there, and they may be doubling into each other in other places.
But seems to be supported too by the migration theory of the tribes coming across to Alaska from the Asia.
Yeah, so that would be just almost a few minutes ago in geological time.
That's right, I'm talking to geologists too.
I guess it's the time scale of the anthropologists and historians. Now this would be on a much different time scale. But so much so that rocks with the same types of fossils, I think, have been matched in South Africa and then in the southern end of South America. So that it would rather look as if those rocks had been formed in a terrain when it was all united. Mm-hmm. But all those things just look like funny coincidences until this new theory, and until this new evidence has come, which now is the prevailing and very exciting theory.
Yes.
And I think it has immense implications in tying into the origin of the folded, the belts of folded rocks and uplift to the present mountain ranges and things of that sort. And we're right on a good active place in California.
Trust you to live on a major fault line.
So I hope I'll still be here for the next big event. But
I do indeed. I intend to phone you and find out what you're doing.
Now we got away.
Well, apparently the sort of rather frame, basically frame house, seems to do rather well.
Oh, I think so, except we have a bad chimney on one side.
Just keep away.
I've warned everybody to keep away from that chimney.
Right.
I would never have built a chimney like that here, but
there are other kinds of chimneys.
Oh, yes, we didn't build a house. Mm-hmm. I like the chimney, but it's, you don't want to live under a chimney.
No.
It's kind of fun. I don't know why they built such big chimneys even after the 1906 earthquake.
I don't know. It's curious, isn't it?
Yes.
There were still these facades and parapets, you know, unanchored
I
parapets.
I know. You can still see some awfully, awfully bad designs. A little bit worrisome.
Yes, I should say. Well, maybe, of course, this is such a fascinating topic.
I
don't want to...
Way off Sarah Pascal.
Well, we can... You know, it all does certainly link very closely together. Maybe we should do a little more on Sarah D'Apostle if there is...
I don't know what I have said
about
that. I went down there in 1919. That was the days you had to go down by steamer. It was about a 2 weeks trip. And then up to the high country by railroad. There were no roads then. In those days, all the exploration was, or our trips were mostly horseback, muleback. We used horses mostly up there. And the roads were very, the railroads were few, and the roads were still fewer. And I think there was, when I was down there first, there was one automobile in Cerro de Pasco, a guy called Stanley Steamer.
Oh, that's nice to know about. One question I thought we might pursue if it interests you, whether you would care to compare the Peruvian copper mines with copper mines in other parts of the world. Are they distinctive in their character, or are there similarities all the way?
There are similarities, but certainly rather some very distinctive features.
I think I'm going to turn the tape over so
yes.
If you will just hold on to the features, we'll pick them up in just a moment. I'm always a little reluctant to let it go too long because sometimes the end slips and it isn't too
yes.
clear.
Oh, yes.
So we'll just let that.
Remarkable how reliable that machine is.
So, oh, knock on wood, I'm extremely...
Is it? It's not always reliable?
Well, nothing electronic is entirely reliable. But for this kind of thing, this is a good one.
I know it isn't reliable when I use it.
No.
Electronic things.
Well, I always have the feeling there are little tiny men inside making it go around. I don't believe in the theory of electronics. At all.